Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action, All the Time. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, for our Christmas special, we are talking about Batman Returns. But before we get into that, and I introduce my great guest, a quick announcement. I know that episodes have been somewhat sporadic in 2022, and we even actually cancelled the show at one point. But me and my co-host Craig both want to keep it going, particularly since we got picked up by the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network. So next year, we will be coming back as a monthly show, where throughout 2023, we will be looking at the films of 1993. Now, back to today's show, where I may have mentioned I have a great guest, which I do indeed, in the form of reviewer and podcaster, the DTV connoisseur himself, Matt Poirier.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me on.
That's no problem at all. I also hope I pronounced your surname correctly.
Funny, it's so in America, it was Americanized to just Poirier, but really any kind of like variation on it, like what you had there, works. So it's sort of understood that it's not. I think the actual French is like Poirier or something like that. It's French for pear tree. Okay. So yeah, but you got it definitely. Like your variation of it works. So there's no like. I guess I would say there's no real wrong way unless you turn into something like potpourri or something like that, which people used to do when I was in school. So
excellent. Before we get into the episode, and before I give the quick background details of today's film, which I regularly do, tell us a little bit about the DTV connoisseur.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, of course, is the name. I had this idea. This was kind of in the mid-2000s of wanting to do a blog. I'm Blogger. And I came up with this idea, the name of the direct-to-video connoisseur, this idea of wanting to be like, you know, sort of Alistair Cook from Masterpiece Theater, you know, with like, you know, the ascot and the smoking jacket, watching Dolph Lundgren movies. Of course, what I didn't realize, right, is that, you know, direct-to-video connoisseur is a long title. It's not always easy to say. And also, spelling connoisseur correctly can be difficult for people that are kind of just, you know, typing, and typos are very easy. So I learned my first lesson when it came just to making websites and things like that. And so I try to sort of, you know, I kind of am stuck with it now because it's, you know, it's the name of the site and everybody knows it. I had the site Matt Movie Guy, but I lost the domain because I didn't update my credit card. It was like a credit card that expired and they sent me the new credit card and I didn't update the information with the domain site. So who knows who owns Matt Movie Guy now. So it's back to DTV Connoisseur or directvideoconnoisseur.blogspot.com. But yeah, that's the site. And I think, you know, we were chatting about how initially the site was supposed to be everything direct to video. So comedy, horror, sci-fi, action. But the action ones were the ones that tended to stick more. People were you know, kind of throughout the web were finding the action movies and glomming onto those a bit more than the other ones. And so over time, as people were giving me feedback and saying, hey, you should watch this movie, check this one out, it kind of morphed into something that's a little bit more action-oriented than the other ones. Not to say that I don't do other genres, but that's sort of where it's come to be. And I kind of do more action movies than any other type.
Which is exactly why I thought you'd be the perfect guest for this show. Having carried your previous appearances on other podcasts, including another show on the Last in Action Heroes Network, I Must Break This Podcast, the Dolph Lundgren podcast, and KilmerCast. I heard you in both those.
Yeah, those were fun ones. Obviously, I Must Break This Podcast was a Dolph Lundgren thing. I mean, I consider him the, you know, in America, the big home run king is Babe Ruth. He's sort of historical, that, you know, major baseball star. And I always joke that Dolph is the Babe Ruth of DTV action because I have so many, I've done like, I think 64 of his films on the site so far. So it's just like so many of them. And so then I think it was kind of a natural thing. And of course, with Sean, with I Must Break This Podcast, you know, there's so many, I don't know if duds is the right term to use for Dolph movies, but he knows I will talk any Dolph anytime. So a lot of times the ones that nobody else wants to do, he'll say, hey, Matt, are you up for, you know, like Final Inquiry was one that we did. He's like, you know, are you up for talking about this one? Yeah, anything Dolph, I'm ready to do it. So I think that's one way that it kind of helps him that I can pitch in and do some of those ones that nobody else wants to really talk about.
Excellent. So like as normal, I will give some quick background details on the film and then we'll dive straight into it. So Batman Returns was released on June 19th, 1992. It was directed by a little-known director called Tim Burton, who you may know from such films as Edward Scissorhands, Ed Wood, Beetlejuice, Mars Attacks, Sleepy Hollow, a bunch of other stuff. The story credit went to Sam Hahn and Daniel Waters. Hamm's notable credits include the original Batman movie, the Batman 1989, and little-remembered Brendan Fraser fantasy comedy, Monkey Bone. Waters' credits include Heathers, Hudson Hawk, and Demolition Man. And Waters also wrote the screenplay. Critically, it is currently sitting on a 7.1 out of 10 on IMDb, 81% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 88 reviews, 68 on Metacritic based on 23 reviews, and a 3.6 on Letterboxd. All pretty high scores for this show. Box office wise, it made $266.8 million off of an estimated budget between $50 and $80 million, making it the sixth biggest movie of 1992, which is enough to beat out A Few Good Men, but not enough to beat out Lethal Weapon 3 for some reason.
I've been down here too long. It's time for me to ascend.
From the sewers of Gotham, a new villain emerges.
You didn't invite me, so I crashed!
From the rooftops of Gotham, the perfect enemy comes to life. Save this city is a creature of the night.
Hey, Stud. Oh, we had something together.
We do.
While she craves a romance she can sink her claws into, he plots a foul reign of destruction.
My dear penguins, thanks to Batman, the time has come to punish all of Gotham!
You missed.
Above Gotham looms its greatest hero.
So, Matt, tell us about your relationship with this film, where you first saw this film, and kind of what your thoughts on the film were, like, from childhood.
Yeah, it's funny. The very first thing to mention is that I didn't realize this movie came out on June 19th, 1992, which was my dad's 40th birthday. So just think about the fact that my dad was 40 at that time. I'm now 43. At that time, 40 seemed so old, and now I'm older than that. So he just turned 70 this year, obviously, because the movie's, you know, 30 years old. So that one piece there, just sort of just as a sideline there. But I think for me, I didn't realize how good this movie was when I saw it. I was 13, you know, when it came out, and I was still a little stunned from the first Batman, just because I went into that first Batman expecting the old TV show that I used to watch with my dad on Sunday mornings. I played reruns of it. And so I'm going in expecting the pow, boom, you know, and Adam West doing, you know, it's kind of dancing with his fingers across his eyes and, you know, Cesar Romero and all of that. And I get people, you know, disfigured by acid and, you know, kind of all this kind of crazy stuff. But as a 10-year-old, it just kind of, you know, it kind of freaked me out. And I think I was still getting over that when I saw this one, but I did like this one a little bit better, you know, just at the time as a 13-year-old. And then I left it for many years, and a friend of mine said, hey, have you seen Batman Returns? It's amazing. And I watched it again and I was like, wow, all these things that I missed when as a 13-year-old just kind of came back and I was like, wow, you know, there's more that I appreciated about it. But even as a 13-year-old, I did like, you know, the sets that were in the film. I liked the idea of who the Penguin and Catwoman were. I liked Tim Burton at that time. I was a fan of his work from, you know, Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands. So it, you know, it was a movie that I enjoyed, but I don't think I appreciated it at 13 like I do now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously you don't appreciate things as a kid quite in the same way. I remember this film kind of scared me because I'm slightly younger than you. So like when this film came out, I didn't see it at the cinema. Well, I probably saw it when it came out in VHS about a year after or something like that. So I would have been about 8 or 9. I remember this, just some points in the movie kind of freaked me out. But I do remember even as a kid really liking it just because I guess I was always drawn, you know, to like, you know, I'm like a horror guy, I'm a metal guy and stuff like that. And I was always kind of drawn to kind of weird gothic-y kind of stuff. So I think even as a child, this was kind of within my wheelhouse, even though there is certain scenes in the movie, particularly towards the end of the movie, that was like kind of traumatized me a little.
Yes. Yeah, that I can see, because I think that's where I had the same thing happen to me with the first Batman, where I was just like, what am I watching? Like it was, people always joke, like, what was the worst film experience that you ever had? And I think that might've been it for me. It was just like, I don't even know how I lasted the whole movie. And I don't know why they just let, you know, I don't know if it's different, you know, where you grew up in the UK versus America, where like in America, if the movie's not an R-rated movie, they just let anybody in. And then if it's an R-rated movie, they may just let anybody in, or the parent can just sign their child in. The parent doesn't have to accompany them. So as a 10-year-old, like they must have known what I was getting myself into and just thought, ah, what's, you know, and to be fair, there are plenty of 10-year-olds, plenty of friends of mine that were 10 at the same time who weren't as freaked out as I was by the movie. So maybe they were right to not worry about me going into it.
Yeah. And we've talked about this on the podcast before. I feel like, because we're of a similar age bracket, you're 43, I'm 37. We grew up at like a weird time because there's lots of things that are in kind of movies that are for kids that wouldn't be in movies now. Like, you know, I always use the example of like the face melting Nazis at the end of like Raiders of the Lost Ark and stuff like that. You know, it's just like, oh, this was a movie for kids back in the day. But, you know, it's like, really? And also there was a thing of, I became aware of lots of adult franchises through cartoons, because Conan had a cartoon, RoboCop had a cartoon, The Toxic Avenger had a cartoon. You know, I became aware of all these things through cartoons. I was like, oh, what are these things? You know, this is a cool cartoon. I wonder what else is available about this character.
It's almost like the camel cartoon for the cigarettes, right? That gets kids to want to smoke cigarettes, right? That you see the cartoon for these adult movies and you're like, oh, I want to see what this Toxic Avenger is. Yeah, I mean, Toxic Avenger, I guess the one difference between Toxic Avenger and some of the Batman movies is like the cartoonish violence in those was so ridiculous. But even that, I think as a kid, sometimes you can't discern the difference.
Sure. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, once you, obviously the violence in Toxic Avenger is so over the, even like the extreme gore of it is so over the top that it's just ridiculous. But again, yeah, I think as like a kid, you probably wouldn't pick that up in the same way. You know, once you get into your teens, sure, yes, but like if you're like a 10-year-old, probably not.
right, exactly. I think I remember Friday the 13th, I was afraid to watch those as a kid. And my buddy was just like, let's, you know, we're going to, there was one on TV and he was like, let's just watch it. You'll be fine. And I realized like, yeah, this actually isn't so bad. It's kind of ridiculous more. And it was almost like the fear of the unknown made it worse than actually sitting in and watching it.
I mean, for sure. I think that there's, you know, your imagination goes wild. And I think that it's kind of one of those things that because everybody watches things via streaming now, nobody will kind of, under the age of like 30, will kind of understand that kind of childhood trauma of like going through a video store and looking at VHS covers and going like, holy crap, I wonder what that movie is.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And also I think too of like being stuck, right? Like if you're watching, you know, Batman Returns or whatever, and you're streaming it, it's easy to turn it off. Whereas like when you're in the theater, it's like, man, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to run out of the theater and wait, you know, an hour sitting on the curb for my parents to come pick me up. It's like, well, no, I'm going to stick it out and see what happens.
So first of all, I think we should talk about the structure of the movie. And Batman Returns, I feel, is a slightly divisive Batman movie. I think some people love it and some kind of Bat fans are like really not for it. And I think like one of the kind of criticisms that are sometimes laid at it amongst kind of hardcore kind of Batman fans who want Batman is the fact that it's mainly not a Batman movie. And the focus was really on the villains, the Penguin and Catwoman, who's not really a villain, is kind of like a kind of semi-villain, semi-anti-hero type. But it's really their stories. What's your feeling on that? Do you think that works?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is probably one of my all-time favorite comic book movies. And I think because for me, Tim Burton does something so kind of outside the norm. Like you said, like he's focusing on, you know, the Danny DeVito character, Michelle Pfeiffer's character. And like you said, we get Michael Keaton in kind of fits and starts, even just as Batman. He's not in it that much. And for me, I really like that. But I think that that does kind of speak to that point of like, people who are looking for a comic book movie or looking for, like you said, a Batman movie. I mean, the fact that we get that series, the Christopher Nolan series with Christian Bale, and then we've got the newest one right now, which is it's a 3-hour movie, but so many people really liked it and talked about how much they liked it, despite how long it was. And the fact that it's like, okay, we've seen dark Batman, you know, all the time. I think there is a type of Batman that people really look for. That's the reason why, like, I don't know if you ever see on the internet, they talk about who is the best Batman of all time. And they don't put Adam West, right? It's like the idea of the old Batman is just so silly to people that they don't even want to consider it as part of the Batman thing. And so I can kind of see how this movie would rub up against that some, where it's more a Tim Burton movie than it's a Batman movie almost.
And that, I mean, particularly looking back on it now, that is like an unusual thing. Yes. You know, because obviously there is certain movies, you know, considering the MCU movies, which I like most of the MCU movies, so I'm not shitting on them or anything, but most of them are like MCU movies first and then whoever's directing them second. And you can get there's stronger director DNA in certain movies, like the DNA of James Gunn in Guardians of the Galaxy or the DNA of Taika Waititi in Thor Ragnarok or whatever, but they're always an MCU movie first. And it's the same with other comic book movies. So it is very unusual for a studio comic book movie anyway, that the director is first. And I guess it's because they were still perfecting the formula. You know, if you've watched a lot of comic book movies from the 90s, it's a very, very, very mixed bag.
Yeah, and especially with Batman, you know, I remember at the time, I think almost at the exact time that this came out, DC put out a trading card set to sort of match, because Marvel had put out some trading card sets of all their characters. So they put out their own trading card set, but they had lost the rights to Batman as to be able to make trading cards, because the movies needed their own trading cards to go with them. And so there was almost a sense that even DC didn't know what they were doing with all this. I mean, you know, Superman had the canon film that didn't do well, you know, Superman 4. And now suddenly they've got this success with Batman. And it was almost like they wanted to let it ride. But like you said, like I think for comic book fans, and it's, you know, thinking about myself at that time, and I was more of a Marvel fan. I think DC had like Lobo, who I enjoyed, but I was more Marvel, but then Image too at that time, you know, where all of those really great artists from Marvel kind of broke off and did their own thing. So Batman wasn't really something that I was thinking about beyond like these movies. And I think that was a part of it that I think for me, maybe it's hard for me to sort of put myself in the place of somebody who was buying Batman comics all the time, who was looking for something that was akin to those comics and got, you know, essentially, you know, Edward Scissorhands in a comic book movie or something like that, or Beetlejuice.
And I think, I mean, obviously kind of characters kind of come and go in terms of their popularity. And I think that in terms, obviously Batman 1989 was a massive hit, but Batman kind of had a peak as a comic book character in kind of the mid 80s, so maybe slightly before your time, and then he had like another peak in terms of like comic readers. And I think it's largely to do with this movie, because 1992 is the year this movie comes out, and it's also the year that Batman the Animated Series comes out. So like, right, for my generation, like really hooked on to Batman because it's like, you know, that kind of, you were like Batman comics. And I think the other thing, the thing I enjoy about this movie and the reason that I don't quite get the criticism that's like, oh, well, it's all about the villains, is for me, Batman, much like Spider-Man, even though I like both characters, they have the strongest villains of any comic book characters, in my opinion, the strongest gallery of villains. So why not use that? And, you know, I mean, like, they just have the most entertaining villains.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I think that's one of the problems, I think, with Batman and Spider-Man is that, yeah, when you're making the movies, it's like, okay, well, there's so many villains to choose from. And, you know, sometimes like you put two in a movie, which is kind of what the that's one of the paradigms I think that this film sets up, right? Is that every film from this one on has two bad villains in it, at least in this, you know, sort of Burton Schumacher franchise. And then I think they kind of ran into the same issue with I guess they didn't so much with the Nolan ones. They did in some spots they'd have two villains, but I think you're right there that it's the villains gallery was so fantastic with both of them. And I always think of that too, that like there really isn't another one. I mean, Superman just has Lex Luthor, and then there's, you know, villains here or there that kind of work, but not to the same level that it's like you could make movies themselves about some of these. I mean, the Joker is one that so many people love. They made a movie just about the Joker that worked well. So you're right. Like in a way, I think Tim Burton maybe looked at it that the same way and said, wow, these are some really interesting baddies that I've got here. And maybe two on the backs of the back of Nicholson's performance in the first movie. Maybe I can play this up more and make a more compelling film.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, like you say, it is kind of like a Tim Burton movie first, because it's got all his kind of preoccupations about kind of outsiders and quote unquote freaks and how society treats said quote unquote freaks. And, you know, so it's very Burton-esque throughout.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, even the very beginning of the film, like, I just read in the trivia that apparently they wanted Burgess Meredith to play the father of Oswald Cobblepot, but they ended up getting Paul Rubens for it. And I mean, you see Paul Rubens with his long cigarette that's very, you know, what we think of as the Penguin, almost like kind of connecting, like, here's that comic book Penguin, and then here's what I'm going to do with the Penguin to make it very much, you know, from what I like. And, you know, I always think of the Penguin as kind of being more that, you know, Paul Rubens thing that we saw at the very beginning of the movie. And when you get this completely different thing, I think you're right. It's like, for some people, they're going to, you know, like really latch onto it and say, this is amazing. This is like, you know, I mean, that was what my friend talked about when he was telling me to revisit. He's like, man, when you see him like eating raw fish, you know, while they're like taking him downstairs to the mayor, you know, like that's really just like intense stuff like that, you know, that they came up with for the hit where Danny DeVito is the baddie. And yeah, it's like, I think almost in a way, right, he's almost more fascinated with the idea of the Penguin than he is what he can do with Batman.
Absolutely. And it's quite funny because like one of the things that, you know, got this film in trouble and ended up with the toy line failing and basically the Happy Meal line being discontinued and all the things that came out of this movie and basically ended up with Tim Burton being shown the door and Joel Schumacher being brought into this franchise. Was one of the things was like the black saliva of Penguin, which is totally a Danny DeVito invention. He was mucking about with a makeup artist and was like, oh, you know, if you created this thing, I think that would be an interesting look. And apparently that was one of the things that some of the sponsors were freaked out by.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I never really considered about this, right, is that this is where Tim Burton rubs up against like kind of the machine, like the blockbuster machine, where it's like, yeah, like, you know, you think of the next movie after this, you know, Batman Forever, where you've got a similar kind of a character in Tommy Lee Jones, where his character is supposed to be disfigured, but he's disfigured in this very cartoonish way that like a child could look at that and not be scared. Whereas the Penguin in this is very scary. I mean, he's just very, you know, it's very much a Tim Burton character. And yeah, you can't really sell Happy Meals with Danny DeVito's, you know, Penguin on the cover.
And I mean, like particularly for a kid, he is quite scary because of the way, you know, he's got those kind of vinyl gloves on his flippers and he's got those like little tiny, really sharp teeth, and you know, he's it's got this kind of gray makeup on and this really kind of greasy looking straggly hair. And yeah, even some of the moments in the film of like you know, particularly when he like bites that guy's nose, he's like, oh yeah, it could be worse. I could have a bloody nose. And the guy's like, bloody nose? And he just attacks the guy and takes a chunk out of his nose. It's like, there's certain scenes you're like, holy crap.
right, exactly. And you know, I never really considered too that Michelle Pfeiffer's character, I mean, that Catwoman outfit, it takes the 60s Catwoman outfit, which was sexy in itself, and turns it into this like very like dominatrix, you know, much more illicit kind of thing that I think also too is again something that's hard to sell to families, you know, that like, oh, here's this Catwoman dressed up like this, you know, this S&M dominatrix woman. And I think when you get into like the 90s into the 2000s, you know, women in action films, they're still kind of in these sort of sexy one piece outfits, but not to the degree of what Tim Burton does here. And I think I read that Michelle Pfeiffer was like, I never put that outfit on again after wearing it in the film. But even that is something that might be too racy to be putting on Happy Meals and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And it is kind of funny because like, this is the, I remembered, it's been a while since I kind of rewatched this movie. And I remembered a lot of the kind of dark kind of horror-ish sequences and images. And I remembered like a lot of the violence. And I remember like a lot of the kind of iconic scenes in the movie. I don't really remember as the sex stuff as much. Like, I didn't remember how much of a sex pest the Penguin was, for example, and like all that kind of creeping onto his campaign aides. Like, did you remember any of that?
Not to the degree, right? Like it was, I think really the only time I really remembered it is the point where he hits on Michelle, you know, on Catwoman, and she rebuffs him, and he kind of like attaches an umbrella to her to kind of make her fly
yeah,
away.
I always remember that scene. Yes. That's
But beyond that, you're right. Like, I don't like, for example, hitting on Jan Hooks's character, but I think maybe because my memory only went to the biting of the other guy's nose and sure. Jan Hooks sort of like trying to help him. And I hadn't really, you know, you're right. I didn't think about that to the same degree either. You know, I think that maybe again, when you're younger, you don't catch it as much if it's not so blatant.
Yeah. And I guess like you probably wouldn't get all the innuendos and all the language of, you know, when you're a kid, particularly as a kind of preteen, like, you know, when Max Schreck, you know, played by Christopher Walken, is telling him all the perks of being the mayor, and then saying, and it also includes all the poontang you want. I don't think, as the first time I saw this, as like an 8 or 9 year old, I would know what poontang was.
Right. I didn't even remember that being in there. And I was like, yeah, I didn't even think, like, I think I'd heard that word later, you know, as I was a little bit older, and probably didn't even remember it being in there and didn't even think of it as something that would have been in a movie like that. I was almost like, oh yeah, people were saying that even back then kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, like, for a film that is essentially for kids, some of the sexual innuendo is quite hilarious, particularly when Catwoman appears on the Penguin's bed and he says, just the pussy I was looking for.
Right, exactly. I mean, and even just like that outfit, you know, I think of Lee Merriweather, you know, or Eartha Kitt, or, you know, Julie Newmar, who played that character. And, you know, I think when I think of the Catwoman movie that was a flop that Halle Berry did, yeah, where, you know, she's kind of wearing like pants and like maybe like a bra top or something like that. Whereas the real Catwoman outfit that really works is this sort of like almost like a second skin that like mimics nudity in a way, but isn't nude, right? So it's almost like she's showing this revealing self, but yet she's not showing you anything. You know, she's not showing anything of her skin. And then the way that Tim Burton does it, where it's starting to kind of peel apart a little bit or fall apart in places. So yeah, it's almost like she doesn't have the ability to be fully like that 60s Catwoman who is completely together. And, you know, again, is like sort of showing this second skin, but not revealing anything. Whereas here is, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer's character doing that same sexuality piece, but yet not quite having it all together in the same way that you see almost like chinks in the armor, which I really appreciated as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, Michelle Pfeiffer, it should be said, and I think everybody knows this, is amazing in this movie, but there is a slightly kind of manic unhinged quality to the performance. And, you know, there is little moments throughout that kind of accentuate that. I think one of the funniest moments that, you know, you're talking about the costume is when we have the compare and contrast of, like, this is obviously skipping ahead towards the finale, but when Batman is ceremonially putting on his Batman costume, which, you know, you kind of think, like, you should be doing this a bit quicker. There's an emergency going on. But, and she's doing like a quick change in the car. And this is, it's quite a funny kind of compare and contrast.
Yeah. And I, this was another piece that I kind of had to remind myself of in watching the film at that time, is that, you know, Michael Keaton, people still hadn't really accepted him as Batman in 89. Like, they just didn't think that, you know, that he was that character. And when you see him walking next to Christopher Walken, you see how short he is. You know, he was still Mr. Mom, I think, to a lot of people. And it's almost like in this movie, there's almost like, I don't want to say a ridiculousness to Batman, but there is a little bit of a piece of him that Tim Burton puts in there that's almost like he's this rich guy who's maybe a little full of himself. But there is a little bit of, I don't even want to say silliness, but there's almost like a kind of a BS aspect to him that, like you said, like, he takes his time getting on his Batman suit when there's an emergency in the city. But it's almost like part of, like, almost like the parody that the little bit of parody that Tim Burton was sort of including in that role, that I think for Michael Keaton, he was the perfect person to play that, to have that little bit in there. I mean, I remember the first movie had moments like that too, like when he and Vicki Vale are eating dinner and they're in this huge table and he has to give her the salt and he's like walking out of the end. And so he had, I think almost like he played that up a little bit more because he felt like he could. And again, that's probably another area where people who are huge Batman fans didn't like it. They don't like the idea of a Batman who is flawed in that way. That has flaws that are obvious, that Tim Burton's poking fun at almost in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's kind of like a well-known thing that you kind of bring up in terms of, you know, you talked previously about kind of best Batmans and who played it best. And that's kind of the interesting thing. You know, some people still kind of don't like Michael Keaton's Batman. Now, I do like Michael Keaton's Batman. And obviously, most people don't like Michael Keaton's Batman because they don't think of him as like a badass. Because Michael Keaton, he's only about 5'9". He maybe weighs about 160 pounds, whatever, something like that. So, like, they think he's too short. He's not muscular enough. You know, it's not like the way that, like, Christian Bale got, you know, bulked up. And, you know, Christian Bale was like 6 foot tall or whatever. And, you know, he bulked himself up to like 220 or something like that. But the reason I think Michael Keaton does work, and the reason that I think he still kind of comes across badass, is because it's just the kind of sense of, like, madness. He's got like a kind of dark, manic energy that you're like, nah, I don't want to mess with this guy. He might not look all that tough, but I just feel like he's going to mess me up in a way that, you know, I can't even think of.
Right, like when in the beginning of the film, when he rotates the Batmobile and burns a guy alive with the exhaust, you know, with the flaming, you know, backfire of the engine. I mean, I think that, I don't know that there is, I mean, again, I haven't seen the newest Batman just because I haven't been able to get myself geared up for the 3 hours for it. I think my brain is too velocitized with the 90-minute action films I watch all the time. And so, and so this movie, of course, is like the perfect length at just over 2 hours. But I can't think of many, like, more, gruesome Batman deaths. And it's like a very quick kind of thing that happens too when he does it. So you're right. There's a sense of him that, like, he was gonna, he could take care of you. He would take you out and do it in a way that was kind of almost sadistic when he did it.
Yeah, but I do think that this is another thing that I kind of was thinking about while watching the film, because obviously after Batman versus Superman, there was this great debate about, like, does Batman kill people? The moral code of Batman, is this pushing it too far? And obviously, watching this film, there's two pretty brutal deaths. You know, the one where you just mentioned about burning the guy alive, and then the other where he stuffs dynamite down a guy's pants and then throws him down the sewer, and then he just blows up. But the reason that I enjoy that, and I don't think it pushes it too far, is because of the kind of cartoonish black humor to it. And the reason I reacted against the kind of bat flick of Batman versus Superman, because he just didn't feel like Batman to me. He just felt like Paul Kersey or Cobra or something.
Yeah. And there was almost a sense too. I think this is one of the things that comes up with DC, as they're almost like trying to do what Marvel did with the MCU. And, you know, I think all these years we'd wanted Batman and Superman to be in a film together. But I think the problem is, that Superman is always going to be what for the Marvel movies would be like the supervillain, right? You know, he's nearly omnipotent and he can do all of this stuff. And so then when you put Batman and him together, it's like, well, how do you figure out a way to make that so like Batman's maybe a villain or Superman's a villain, or they fight each other, and how does the fighting work, and you know, how do they become friends and all that? It's almost like with DC. I mean, you know, DC would do it in their comics, right, with the Justice League and all of that, where they'd pair Batman and Superman up. But there's almost a sense, like you said, Batman has enough of a rogues gallery that it's like, how much do we need the two of them together, the way that having Iron Man with the Hulk and Captain America works? It's almost like it doesn't quite fit with them. And I think, like you said, when they made Batman for the Batman versus Superman, I think they, like you said, he just feels like, you know, he's in Death Wish or something like that. And part because I think they didn't know how to put those two together. That's kind of how it felt for me.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, that's very true. And maybe, like, I guess the Iron Man and Spider-Man and the Incredible Hulk and Captain America and the Fantastic Four and all those characters feel like they exist in the same universe.
Yeah.
So, like, I think that it's... So it's easier to pair them up. Whereas, like, Batman and Superman, I think, is harder to pair up because, like, the analogy that I've sometimes heard is Metropolis is New York in the daytime and Gotham is New York at night.
Yeah.
And so because they come from two different universes, it's a bit like if you paired up the kind of big Marvel heroes with the kind of ground level Marvel heroes. So if you paired up like Iron Man and Punisher, or you know, Captain America and Daredevil, I don't think that would work as well because they come from two, you know, they come from what kind of light and dark universes.
Yeah, I think that's another great point too. And and it's like even just sort of in the geography of the United States, I think they kind of like put Gotham and Metropolis as separate from New York, and they're almost like in this area that's kind of like in between New York and Philadelphia, I think. Because I didn't even know there was a Philadelphia in DC until I saw Shazam, and that movie takes place in Philadelphia. So there's even that part of it too, where it's like you said, like I think in that Batman versus Superman movie, there's the scene where, you know, Ben Affleck as Bruce Wayne attends a party that's being held by Lex Luthor. And there's just an idea that like, almost like, you know, Batman and Lex Luthor don't belong together. And even though it makes sense that they'd be together because they're both, you know, these millionaires that they should be. But you're right. I think that the Batman, like you said, yeah, he's kind of the dark character. He's the Daredevil, the Moon Knight, you know, something like that. Whereas Iron Man would do kind of or Captain America, like you said, they're the daytime ones. But they're going on these bigger missions, right? Like, you know, Daredevil's fighting the Kingpin or Punisher's fighting Jigsaw. They're fighting like mob bosses in New York City. Whereas Iron Man and Thor those guys, they're fighting like, you know, some big, you know, major villain, super villain who's like, you know, trying to blow up the planet or something like that.
Exactly. And so, yeah, it makes it kind of weird, you know, because like Batman shouldn't be fighting like cosmic beings and gods and stuff. Yeah. You know, he should be fighting like, you know, kind of weirdo mob bosses, you know?
Right. Cause that's the thing too, right? When you look at the villains gallery of Batman, as opposed to like the Spider-Man's villain gallery, the Batman's villain gallery, none of them really have special powers, right? They're, and I mean, that's another area where the departure comes in with the Tim Burton Batman, where it's almost like there is something like, you know, like especially with Michelle Pfeiffer's character, it's almost like this sort of mystical like infusion of cat energy into her. But they don't have special powers. Whereas like Superman, when he's fighting people, yeah, they're like you said, they're these cosmic beings that come from somewhere. Or, you know, Wonder Woman is fighting, you know, the God of War in her movie. And Batman's supposed to be fighting the Joker, who's like a supervillain who's depraved, but he doesn't have like superhuman strength or the ability to shoot lasers out of his eyes or anything like that. He's just, like you said, he's another mob boss or something like that.
So you mentioned the thing about Michelle Pfeiffer. Did that work for you? The fact that there's no like explanation within the movie of like her apparent supernatural abilities based on the whole mythology of cats having nine lives.
Yeah, I think the only thing about it was like kind of quicker. It was kind of just sort of like thrown in there in a way that was very different from the way the Penguin and the Joker in the previous film had a much more a greater explanation for it. I mean, yes, you do have to suspend some belief that penguins are raising a baby to get what's happening with the penguin. But at least you understand that like there's a history there. And I think you're right that it was kind of a quicker thing with the cats and like how are the cats able to infuse this energy in her that gives her the ability to do acrobatics and things like that.
And it is one of those kind of sometimes silly touches work and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And it is very silly that like Catwoman backflips away from every crime scene, but there's something joyous and great about it.
Right. I think that's where you talked about like Michelle Pfeiffer's performance here. I think for people that watch movies today, there's almost a sense that people almost have forgotten how good Michelle Pfeiffer is. I mean, she's in a lot of ways, when I was watching this, I was thinking, she's what people think Margot Robbie is. That's who Michelle Pfeiffer was. She's what people expect Margot Robbie to be, but really isn't, but they're kind of okay with it. Michelle Pfeiffer really delivers that kind of performance in this. And in that sense, you almost, like you said, you almost kind of forget that there's kind of that silliness with the cats eating her, you know, chewing her fingers and stuff and turning her into some kind of a cat woman. She plays the performance so well that I was so engrossed in it that I kind of forgot about how she became Catwoman.
I do think her performance throughout is glorious. I particularly the kind of scene, the kind of mirror scene where she comes into the apartment and says, "Hi, honey. Oh, I forgot I'm not married." And then checks her like answer machine and all that. And then, you know, before she becomes Catwoman and then just after she becomes Catwoman, and she does basically the same scene again, but in a kind of weird, zonked out, zombified state. I think that scene is great.
Yeah, that whole set that he created for her apartment was really amazing with the colors, the neon signs, the sort of the mix of old and new. I think the answering machine is kind of new, but there's other pieces of her that were old. And then the way that like when she is transforming herself into Catwoman and she starts destroying the space and turning it into more of a Catwoman's place, the way that set starts to break down, I thought that whole thing was fantastic. And again, the way she interacts with it was just like kind of like you said, it was glorious. It was like another level that just kind of made that whole thing work.
And I think like the last shot of that sequence is great, where you have, she had this neon sign that said "hello there," but like she knocked out a couple of the letters, so it says, you see this window that says "hell here," and then you see the full reveal of her as Catwoman in the full costume for the first time.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I mean, again, you know, the fact that she's able to make a Catwoman costume out of just a coat that looks like it probably went down to about her waist is again an area where we're suspending reality a bit. But you're right, like it was very much Tim Burton infusing his energy into this role or into this movie, and Michelle Pfeiffer just getting it on every level, which again, we take for granted that someone like Michael Keaton, who had worked with him multiple times, would get it, right? That he gets what Burton's going for and he's going to deliver that. But for Michelle Pfeiffer to come in and really nail it that way, and it the whole thing worked. Like you said, that reveal, and like you said, the hell here, the fact that, you know, you see the neon sign in there, and that in itself was cool to begin with. And then she starts smashing it, and you think she's just doing it like kind of at random. And then you see that no, she's changing the sign, so it says something different.
Also, one of the things I read in kind of background research, which I think is amazing, and you can like see a video of it on YouTube. Basically, Michelle Pfeiffer, when she was whipping the heads off the mannequins, she did that in the first take. And then she improvised the skipping because she was so pleased with herself that she had, because she'd been working with a whip master for like weeks before the filming. And she was so pleased with herself, she skipped away in a kind of improv, you know, a bit of joyous improv.
Yeah. And again, it was like, it's funny because she hated that costume. She hated being in that costume. But yet she lived, I guess that's maybe the true mark of an actor, that they can be in a situation that they completely hate like that. But yet, like you say, do something really successfully, find joy in it, that like she had immersed herself and learned to use the whip that well. I think I saw that video on Twitter. I think somebody had posted it on Twitter. And I just kind of made me like love that she, you know, her role in this even more. But yeah, it's amazing kind of those little touches that happen in a movie that like, you just take for granted that maybe they use special effects to knock the heads off. But no, she did it herself.
Also, you mentioned CGI there. One of the things that probably people thought might be CGI, but actually wasn't, is when Catwoman is in the kind of penguin's lair and she puts the bird in her mouth and then lets it go. That was a live bird that Michelle Pfeiffer put in her mouth.
Which I can only imagine like what, you know, again, I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Is that, you know, I think we see sometimes, like, I think, like, again, going back to Margot Robbie, I think she was really invested in playing Poison Ivy, especially in the Birds of Prey movie. But I think for these comic book movies, there's almost a sense of like, you know, this is a huge paycheck for me and it's good for me to play that part and be in that role. But, you know, I'm not going to put a bird in my mouth or do some of those kinds of things. And I think the fact that she and Danny DeVito as well, I mean, Danny DeVito was putting himself through like hours of makeup every day to play the part. And I guess he would stay in character between scenes. The fact that you have people playing these villains to this degree, I think is, again, something that you don't always see nowadays with comic book movies. Not to say that the comic book movies today are bad or anything, but, you know, I think you just kind of, belies how special Michelle Pfeiffer's performance was in this.
I think like throughout the movie, there is this like kind of level of madness in the movie. There's like this kind of cracked manic energy through a lot of the performances. Obviously, throughout the four main performances in Michael Keaton as Batman, Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, Danny DeVito as Penguin, and we've not really talked about him that much, Christopher Walken as Max Schreck.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher Walken as Max Schreck was so much like that throwback, like, you know, robber baron villain kind of thing, that it was so amazing to see him play that part the way he did, that, you know, you don't see villains like him in movies as often anymore. That's sort of an old-timey kind of villain character that I really loved his performance there.
And his, like, the way his character is styled in costume is, like you say, it's very throwback. His suit is almost Beetlejuice-esque. He's got this kind of wild gray hair. And yeah, like you say, it's this kind of old-fashioned kind of robber baron industrialist.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, I think that's part of it too, is that it takes someone like Christopher Walken, who probably recognizes what, you know, Tim Burton wanted for that role, to play the part. I think of, like, there was also a little bit of Dr. Mabuse in there, the Fritz Lang film. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit, I mean, the movie has a lot of Fritz Lang feel to it anyway, and sort of the sets and a kind of Metropolis feel. But yeah, it was like almost like there's almost like a sense of like even like a silent villain kind of character in there. Obviously, he's speaking throughout the film, but the way he, you know, I mean, Christopher Walken emotes in a certain way anyway that's unique to him, but he plays that part so well. And as a villain, the way he's sort of manipulating the Penguin is a fascinating piece too, to see that interplay. I think, you know, with Michelle Pfeiffer as well, a lot of times when we see these movies that have multiple villains, you don't always see that kind of interplay where they're all kind of using each other and possibly going to backstab each other, because they're all villains, right? They don't really have any allegiance to anyone.
Usually you get more of like, oh, we're villains and we want to backstab each other, but we're going to team up for a common cause because we want to bring down Batman. Whereas these villains are just like constantly undercutting each other, even when they do have a common cause. It's like, oh, we have the common cause of bringing down Batman, but also I'm a villain, so I'm going to double cross you.
Right, exactly. Especially, I think, you know, and then the other thing too, of course, that I think, you know, Tim Burton plays really well with is like, okay, Michelle Pfeiffer's character, you know, Catwoman's a villain, but not, you know, she was always kind of in that middle ground as a villain. I think the old TV series played her more straight up as a villain who would have, you know, sort of sexual intrigue with Batman. But, you know, she had her gang of baddies and she was ready to do whatever bad stuff she had to do. Whereas I think in the comic books, there was always a kind of a sense of like Catwoman was bad at times, but could be good at others. And it's interesting how that starts to play out as she's interacting with the Penguin more, where it's like, well, we want to take out Batman together, but, you know, Penguin wants to kill a bunch of children. Maybe that's a little bit too much that I'm not really interested. Or when he kills the Ice Queen and she's like, I thought you were supposed to scare her. And he's like, well, she looked pretty scared to me, you know, and she starts to realize like, maybe I shouldn't be pairing myself with this guy you know, I've got my own mission and I thought maybe he could help me with that. But, you know, maybe we don't see eye to eye. Whereas like, I think in a lot of movies, it's kind of like, okay, let's get these baddies together and make it doubly hard on the hero to fight them.
I do think, yeah, the film kind of keeps her within this kind of gray area of like, you do see her blowing things up, you do see her stealing things. But at the same time, there's all these kind of touches that like, you're still kind of on her side. First of all, you're on her side because initially she's quote unquote murdered by Max Schreck. But then even once she becomes Catwoman, there's things like she disarms the security guards of the shopping mall, but lets them go. And then also she saves that woman from a rapist. So like there's these moments that you're still kind of on her side, even though it's like, yeah, she does some bad things, but you know, she's not all bad.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there is almost kind of a sense too, because the outfit is so sexy of like, you know, is she able to get away with more because of that, right? Like, you know, like, well, you know, we kind of forgive more perhaps as a male audience maybe or whatever. You know, there's almost a sense of that too that I think is infused in there. But you're right that like Catwoman's always kind of been a gray area character. I know the way Christopher Nolan used her with Anne Hathaway was that, you know, they sort of, her and Batman get together at the end of the film and she becomes more of a good guy than, or, you know, a hero than a baddie. This film, it's Tim Burton kind of doesn't want to let her go that route because he's like, no, she's mentally unwell from what she's gone through here with this, you know, this sort of this transformation into Catwoman. So just to have her suddenly like her marry Batman at the end or something like that is not, it is not in fitting with what he created for a character for her.
There is, you know, particularly at a kind of that end sequence, there's like a recognition there that they're not, she has a kind of moment of clarity of like that she's too troubled and he's too troubled for a fairy tale ending to ever happen. You know, a fairy tale ending can't happen because of that.
Yeah. And that's maybe where Batman is more naive, right? Because he's used to getting his own way as like the rich man who kind of can get his own way all the time. That he's not able to see that it's not going to work out for them. He's just like, well, if I put enough energy into it with all the money I've got, I'll make it work. And she's kind of like, no, we're not going to make it work.
You know, we've talked quite a bit about the kind of the characters of the movie, the central characters anyway, the characters we care most about. We're not talked so much about the action. You know, we're an action podcast. You're right a lot about action. So we should probably talk about some of the action sequences. And I think for the most part, most of the action sequences throughout the movie are really fun. You know, starting with the opening, there's a kind of like, it almost becomes like a running gag that something bad happens during every mayor speech. He does like three speeches throughout the movie and something terrible happens in each speech. And the first speech, which is probably one of the best action sequences, is there's like a giant present on wheels that unleashes the Red Triangle circus gang. And then it causes havoc before Batman swoops in and saves the day. And like we've talked about, burns that guy alive.
Yes. Yeah. What I loved was like, he took a little bit of the old Batman where, you know, the Penguin, Joker, whoever would have this like kind of like gang of thugs that would hang out, you know, and they'd call him, you know, Mr. Joker, Mr. Penguin. And they, you know, would talk with like a bad New York accent and get beaten up by Batman or something. So he takes a little bit of that, But then he kind of infuses it with the Tim Burton aspect of it, where there's a like kind of a ghoulish, like bad, you know, like evil funhouse aspect to the baddies. Also, you know, old Bela Lugosi serial, the Phantom Creeps, where you've got these characters with these big skull heads on that almost look like the baddie, you know, the kind of the bad robot in the Phantom Creeps. And so I really like that bit, those bits there, where it was like it's like the action, it's almost like Tim Burton saying, well, I've got to have action, right? I've got to have the, you know, the karate, the martial arts, the punching, that kind of stuff, but I'm going to do it my way. And I really like to see that merging of Tim Burton with action, the way he did it.
Absolutely. And like, there is that kind of funhouse vibe to it. And I think that one of the best examples of that, particularly in that opening kind of big action set piece, is the Vincent Chevalier's character as the organ grinder that's got the machine gun within the organ grinder. You know, things like that is just very inventive and fun.
Yeah, and Vincent Chevalier, he was one of those you know, sort of character actors from that period. I mean, I remember him in Fast Times at Ridgemont High as the teacher who had his wife had switched him to Sanka, so he was doing decaf coffee and he wasn't happy. You know, he kind of plays these parts in these movies. And because he was so kind of iconic, the way Tim Burton put him in the film, it's almost like there doesn't need to be a lot of character development for what he's doing. He just jumps in and plays that role. And it fits so well with what Burton was going for.
I think Vincent Chevalier is definitely one of those character actors who could just jump into any scene and light up a scene. I mean, one of the movies we covered a few months back was Tomorrow Never Dies. And Vincent Chevalier is in that movie for about 5 minutes. He's just in like one scene. And it's one of the best scenes in the movie. He plays a kind of German professor of torture kind of thing. And he has this great banter with Bond. And it's like, as soon as he dies, he's like, oh man, I could have done with more of him and Bond banter.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many films from sort of the 80s and 90s that he was in that, yeah, I mean, you almost feel like there was like a sense of like that, you know, his agent probably couldn't field them all. You know, I mean, how many movies he would do in a year and how it you just, you know, it's hard to imagine like the 80s and 90s without him in a film. And like you said, you know, when he's in the Bond movie, you know, they probably only had him there for, you know, they only planned to have him for that small period of time. And, you know, again, a production like a Bond movie has so many resources that they can afford to have him be in such a small part. But like you said, you want more of him because he was always so great.
And I think like throughout there's a bunch of like the kind of henchman characters who really stand out that, you know, wouldn't normally stand out in most of these movies, you know. It feels like Tim Burton like really put thought into the design of the henchmen and also the people playing the henchmen, because as well as Vincent Chevalier, I think the couple that stand out for me is like there's a thin, tall clown, which is an early role for Doug Jones. And there's also a tattooed strongman who's played by Over the Top's Rick Zamwalt, who also stands out and is the character who we mentioned gets blown up.
Yeah. And then the clown who is sort of like who's holding Michelle Pfeiffer hostage. And he, you know, Batman defeats him by shooting his grappling hook into the wall and pulling the wall out and hitting him. That's Branscombe Richman from the Renegade TV series, he's someone that you know, does a lot of, you know, a lot of direct-to-video action stuff, a lot of PM Entertainment stuff in particular. And of course, you know, as we're doing this podcast, we're recording this on Monday, is partly, Indigenous Peoples Day. So he's of Native American descent. And so it's kind of cool to see him in that role in a big screen film. I think he did some other big screen films at that time, you know, in these really small parts like this. But that was a cool one. Also, Gregory Scott Cummins was one of the acrobatic thugs. So he of Action USA, you know, probably one of the, you know, the more classics of the DTV action era from the late 80s.
I also remember him in Cliffhanger, which is another movie we covered.
Yeah, he's a great one. I mean, he gets a very small part. I mean, these Batman movies tend to have some of these. I think in it's either Batman Forever or Batman and Robin that Don the Dragon Wilson plays one of the thugs. And, you know, again, right, all dressed up. Yeah, and so it is kind of a fun little thing to catch some of those names. And like you said, like Rick Zumwalt, I mean, I just, you know, over the top. Of course, it's just a classic with Stallone. And of course, like you said, he gets, again, probably up there as one of the most gruesome Batman deaths. And in terms of Batman killing somebody, one of the more gruesome deaths, the way that he dispatches that guy.
And again, it's kind of offset by the kind of comical thing where, Rick Zamwalt's like, hit me. And like Batman hits him and it does nothing. And then he tries to hit him again. And then he's like kind of laughing it off. And then he's just like, look down, and he's got, dynamite shoved into his pants. And then he's like, ah, shit.
Exactly. And that's another thing, maybe coming back to that what we were discussing with Superman versus Batman, that who does Superman have trouble punching, right? He punches anybody. And I mean, Rick Zumwalt, he just, could flick him and knock him, three or four blocks away. Whereas Batman, as a hero, is someone who could be dispatched by a really big guy, right? He would have to use his wits to get out of that, which maybe that's Tim Burton kind of playing with the fact that Batman has to use his wits to sometimes dispatch his baddies, that he does it in a kind of very macabre way, but still in a creative way nonetheless.
I think there is a bunch of kind of creative action sequences, particularly the scene where the Penguin gang steal the Batarang, which is introduced in this film, where it's stolen by a poodle after it knocks out several people.
Right. Yes. I mean, I think that's Tim Burton almost playing with, which that was, a classic thing, right, in the old Batman series, that they would make fun of Batman's gadgets, right? That he's got, shark repellent spray, and, that whenever they were in a jam, and it was like the cliffhanger, when you get to the next one, there's something in Batman's utility belt that would save him and get him out of that. And it's almost like Tim Burton plays with that aspect of it. And even too, when they steal the Batarang and they use that against him, but also when they wire his Batmobile so that the Penguin can control it, it's like this kind of funhouse device, right? That's like kind of like a spinny wheel kind of ball thing that's got that looks kind of like a clownish kind of thing. That, again, it's like, usually in an action movie, when that kind of thing happens, it's a very electronic device, right? It's just like, a black box with an antenna and, maybe a red button and a black button or something like that. And so for it to be that kind of a fun device that he's using there, again, are those little touches that Tim Burton went with in the film.
One of the interesting things about the film that I think wouldn't happen now is, we kind of discussed the thing about like Catwoman's Nine Lives and things like that, where not a lot of things are explained. And I have to say, and I think more things would be explained if this film was made today, but I think it doesn't bother me, because the things that upset me the most is when things don't gel tonally, or things don't gel in terms of character consistency. But kind of random plot things don't bother me. I mean, sometimes they are quite funny when you're like, how did Penguin's gang get the blueprints to the Batmobile? Things like that. But, it's kind of fine. It's like, well, I don't know. Because they're villains and they're creative and I'm sure they got them somehow. but I think even details like that, I think would be more explained if this movie was made today, 30 years later.
Yeah, and I think to your point, you make a really great point about that. Because I think for me, it's like, what would I rather have? Would I rather have them add 20 minutes of plot exposition to explain these things better? Or would I rather that the film is at the running time? And like you said, as long as it tonally feels all right, I think that's probably the difference. And maybe that's the thing, is that maybe Tim Burton was sure of himself as a director at that time, and he also had the control to make the movie that he wanted to make. Whereas nowadays, like you said, with these Marvel cinematic, you're just using that as a good comparison. Or even, thinking of the Justice League movie that kind of went from Zack Snyder to Joss Whedon and sort of all the machinations that happened there, that when the big studio comes in and tells you how the movie has to be made, I think Tim Burton can trust that his movie tonally is fitting the vibe, that he doesn't need to explain everything, and that his audience will get it the way that he's expecting us to. That might be part of the reason too, why they have to make the movie longer and why they have to explain everything, is that the filmmakers don't have the control over the modern movies the way that Tim Burton had the control over this to make it the way he wanted to.
Yeah, I don't think this will really happen again, because obviously the Justice League movie and that whole controversy and the whole Snyderverse thing and whatever, and the latest thing with like the Batgirl movie being scrapped and all that kind of thing. Like, you know, Batman Returns, obviously a Warner Brother movie, and those are all Warner Brother movies. And like, yeah, with these size of movies nowadays, you know, you'd be swamped by Warner Brother execs. But this was actually one of the things that got Tim Burton to sign on. It was like Tim Burton didn't really want to do a sequel, but the Warner Brothers basically turned around to them and said, like, if you make a sequel, you can make it completely your own movie. And then he was just kind of left to it, which is amazing.
Right? Because, I mean, you know, one of the things I think, I mean, there's so many things about this movie, but one of the things that really struck me was like the sets and the fact that this, you know, think of like the Christopher Nolan movies that I think were filmed in Chicago, you know, or, you know, other films like this that are filmed in big city locations, or like, you know, Aquaman was filmed in like, I think in Nova Scotia in the Maritime provinces, but it was supposed to be set in Maine in the United States. That, you know, all of these movies are filmed in like real world locations, where, you know, they, Warner Brothers let Tim Burton take up I think it was like half of the Warner Brothers lot that he used to make the sets. Yeah. And it has that look of like, I mean, you know, Metropolis is one that comes to mind with like the big, you know, carved out heads that were adorning the buildings. I mean, the Max Shrek with the cat thing was just so fantastic. And what you get when he does that, when he's allowed to make it the way he wants, is the movie almost doesn't have a time that it exists in, which, you know, watching it for somebody who, you know, kind of looking for like the 90s nostalgia, there wasn't much. I mean, there's the scene where he's playing a compact disc, which at that time it was new that he would be recording something on a compact disc, because at that time you couldn't really record on compact discs if you didn't have like tons of money, or, you know, if you weren't like a music studio or something. But really, because he made it the way he wanted to make it, it almost exists outside of time. Like, it has its own, you don't know when it takes place, or, you know, what, you know, where it's supposed to even take place. That like Gotham is so its own thing that you can watch this movie at any time and it still feels fresh and new when you watch it.
That's very true. I think like one of the only things I would say is a very 90s touch is where Batman plays the Penguin's audio over his speech, and then he does like a record scratch to play it back, and I was like, oh, that's very kind of early 90s hip-hop's very popular.
Yeah, I remember in the theater that one got a laugh from the entire theater when that scene happened, and everybody kind of got it. And then I think it wasn't long after that I remember a comedian was making fun of the fact that rap was so mainstream, that everywhere, you know, rap was like, you know, when you see cats in commercials rapping and scratching records, you know, it's gotten bad. But you're right. That's definitely probably like the one piece that's like very much. I think the answering machine also was like a very 90s answering machine that she was using that piece for sure. But like the cars were, you know, I was like, but yeah, definitely the record scratch. That's the one thing I think out of everything in that film, that's the one thing I remember from the theater experience was the audience all getting a kick out of that.
You're entirely right. It's kind of at a kind of unknown place in time and space, somewhere between the 40s and the 90s, you know, like with all sorts of different parts kind of, from different eras kind of put in.
Yeah, and I think that was something that I would not have picked up on at the time, you know, as a kid watching this, you know, but like, you know, sort of now, you know, you know, I think for me, a big piece with movies was in the late 90s, AFI put out their 100 movies. And there are a lot of classics on there. And a buddy of mine and I were trying to go through some of the classics that we hadn't seen before, you know, and kind of catch up with some of those. And, you know, you'd get into that section of the video store, the classic section, where it was like some of these tapes were bought in the mid 80s and they were broken. You'd have to like return them and get your money back or get it replaced by something else. And you know, I think Metropolis was one that I saw at that time. You know, there's some others around that time too, you know, that I had seen that, you know, now I come back and watch the Batman Returns and I see where the things that Burton was pulling from, you know, see where he got the inspiration. And it kind of makes it even bigger for me where I'm like, wow, you know, like, you know, just the fact that he used sets like that, like at the time, it didn't really cross my mind that like what that entailed, that he was filming everything on the lot and he'd designed all of these sets like this. And, you know, I think of a time in the early 2000s when Martin Scorsese was making Gangs of New York, you know, he's making that with the you know, with the Weinstein brothers, and he really wasn't, you know, we think of Scorsese who he is now, but at that time he had had some duds, and he kind of wasn't able, someone who could just make his own movie the way he wanted to make it. And he's filming it, and he wanted to build like a three-dimensional church that was just going to be, you know, something that was going to be outside on the set. It wasn't going to be something that anybody went inside. And the Weinsteins were like, no, just make it, you know, just the front. That's all I want. And so Tom Cruise was visiting. I think he was filming Mission Impossible, and he's visiting to talk to Scorsese. And Scorsese complained about that, and Cruise went over to the Weinsteins and said, you know, give Marty his church. And so they built it for him. But, you know, you think of that, that Martin Scorsese had to fight just to get one building like that. And here, yeah. Tim Burton has a whole city worth of buildings. I mean, again, half the Warner Brothers lot that he was able to use to make something like that, that, you know, I didn't have the perspective to understand just what that meant, that he could do that.
On your point about the Scorsese thing, I guess that was, like you say, that wasn't like the highest point in his career. Cause like, you know, cause I think he'd come off like a couple of kind of weak performances at the box office. There was like Kundun that didn't do that well. And then despite the fact it's really good, I just rewatched it this year, Bringing It to the Dead did nothing at the box office.
Right. Yeah. He just wasn't, you know, he wasn't selling. And this Gangs of the New York thing, nobody really knew what it was going to do. And I think, you know, had DiCaprio in it, which I think people were expecting something there. But yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, you're, you know, I think he was filming it in Italy at the, you know, kind of famed Cinecittà, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but Cinecittà, where Fellini would film his movies in Rome. And so it was like, he was, you know, he's already kind of spending all of this money. And yeah, it's like, you know, we think now with Netflix giving him tons of money to make, you know, a 3.5 hour epic about, you know, organized crime here in Philadelphia, where I live, and you know, all of that kind of thing. But, you know, at that time, yeah, he couldn't do that. And so, you know, studios weren't letting people do that kind of thing. And I guess, not that they really do anymore, right? You have to be like a Marvel Cinematic Universe kind of movie to get the freedom to make a movie. And even then, they're going to want to know where the money's going when they're ponying it up. But the fact that Burton got the freedom to make the movie the way he did, yeah. And you can see it in the sets in particular.
Absolutely. Because like you say, it's a totally different market now. And nobody, you know, it's all very much based on the studio and what the studio wants. And like a lot of these people are essentially directors for hire. And unless you are Christopher Nolan, nobody gets $200 million to make their completely original vision of what they want to do.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Because I mean, you think of like, you know, someone like a Jon Favreau, for example, who's like really kind of embedded in Disney with the Marvel and the Star Wars movies. And I think maybe with Mandalorian, he has some freedom in how he wants to do those. But you're talking about like 30-minute films or, you know, 30-minute TV episodes that he's doing there. You know, even that, I think, you know, Disney has their own understanding of these things where they want content coming out on a certain clip so that they can keep selling their Disney Plus streaming packages so that they have, you know, things going in the theater on a regular basis. And I think that's another piece where it was like, this was sort of a different time where Warner Brothers was like, okay, we had this huge success with Batman. We want another Batman movie. Tim Burton, like you said, he wasn't really interested in doing a sequel. He'd done his Batman. So now it's like, okay, well, if I'm making the movie, I'm going to make it the way I want to. And Warner Brothers really didn't have any kind of other, you know, paradigm or there wasn't any other kind of experience or something to draw on for this. It was uncharted territory and what they were going to do and sort of, you know, giving him a chance. Cause I don't think anybody thought that his Batman was going to be as successful as it was. Nobody had really seen a comic book movie like that before. So it was like, you know, let's just let him do it. And that's, this was the result we got.
And I guess, you know, I mean, the kind of original vision thing, I guess with, like you say, with the kind of Disney stuff, with like the Star Wars stuff and the Marvel stuff, you've kind of always got to be aware that, you know, you're just a director and like, you know, the ship is kind of being steered in Marvel's cases by, you know, Kevin Feige, and in Star Wars case by like Kathleen Kennedy, you know, that's the person who's steering the ship the most, you know, of what the brand is about.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of, I kind of wonder, like I said, I haven't taken the energy to see the newest Batman. You know, I did see the Christopher Nolan ones, but I think there's almost a sense now, like, you know, I think DC went a little bit out when they allowed that Birds of Prey movie to be made. And, you know, I think like you know, Black Panther or Captain Marvel that were a little bit different from the paradigm, but they still kind of stick with the same Marvel Cinematic Universe paradigm of the movie where, you know, there's certain things that happen at certain points of the film, whether it's, you know, the heroes trying to work something out, the all hope is lost part of the film, the, oh, we're going to kind of work together and make it happen. You know, they played a little bit with those paradigms, but I don't think you could say like, okay, I'm going to make, you know, a Spider-Man, like the way that Tim Burton made Spider-Man. I mean, you know, even Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, which was a little bit Sam Raimi-ish, but it still was a big blockbuster thing. I don't think any of those, they would, you know, I don't think DC would let anybody make a Batman like this anymore. They just, they wouldn't want anybody to touch it and do it the way he's doing it, which is kind of too bad because these comic book characters, one of the things I always loved about reading comics when I was a kid was that sometimes they would just give a character to somebody who was maybe a little bit outside the mainstream and say, hey, you know, do something different with it. You know, Todd McFarlane with Spider-Man or like Sam Keith with Hulk, doing something that's just completely different with it. I guess with the comic books, they're like, well, you can do like these one-off graphic novels or something. But for some reason, I guess nowadays they're so protective that they don't want to, they're afraid of maybe like what you said, you know, like that if you made a Hulk that's as dark as this Batman, you know, what, you know, how are you going to market it to kids on, you know, with McDonald's and things like that?
One of the things I was also thinking kind of, I kind of completely differently to that, was this Batman, it seems like, you know, the early 90s were just a more innocent times in some ways. It's weird because like, we're talking about a kid's movie essentially that pushes into darker territory than like a modern kid's movie would. But there is a certain innocence to certain things that happen in the movie. For example, the fact that Penguin is, his audio is played during the speech. We mentioned doing the record scratch, but his audio is played during the speech and he is instantly discredited, which is feels much more innocent.
Right. There's no way that this film could have predicted the Access Hollywood tape of Donald Trump and the fact that he survived that. I mean, I remember in 06, there was a candidate for, I don't know if it was Senate or governor in the state of Virginia in the U.S., which Virginia is an interesting state in that it can lean both conservative and liberal. And the conservative candidate, the Republican candidate, he referred to, I think the man was of Philippine descent. It may have been Filipino. I can't remember exactly, but maybe Southeast Asian. But he referred to him as Macaca. And that gaffe was so big that he lost. And it was, I think at that time, it was a big deal if a liberal won in a statewide election in Virginia. And it was big enough that he lost, that you know, he lost the election. You know, now you know, candidates here in the U.S. in particular, they can say all kinds of things. And if they've got the right letter behind their name, you know, they're going to get elected. And so you're absolutely right. Like, you know, the Penguin, if he had an R after his name, he still would have been able to win in certain areas, or a D after his name, he might win in certain parts of the country as well.
It's kind of wild. It's kind of wild. Yeah. Although the thing I do love about that scene is like Tim Burton predicts the audience reaction to the scene. Where he's like, where the Penguin gets all this rotten fruit and veg thrown at him. And then your first thought is like, why do people just have that on them if they're like celebrating the guy? But then the Penguin says himself, why do people always bring rotten tomatoes and eggs to political rallies?
And it was another one of those pieces that was just like very much, I mean, it felt like there were some touches like this that felt very like Three Stooges-esque or, yeah, you know, Marx Brothers or something like that. And yeah, you're right. It's just like one of those things where Tim Burton's just like, well, what happens when somebody's discredited, you know, in a political rally? They get, you know, rotten food thrown at them, so that's what I'm going to do here. And you're right, like that there's almost like a breaking down of the fourth wall where the Penguin's kind of questioning like why that's even happening to him.
I suppose it's like that thing of it depends where you stand on Batman and how serious you want Batman to be, like how much you're going to enjoy this film as opposed to certain other films. But for me, I've always liked the absurdity of comic book films and more broadly, the absurdity of action films and films that lean into that. So like all these little touches really work for me. Like another touch that really cracked me up is when they go to the masked ball and Bruce and Selina, Catwoman and Batman, both turn up unmasked, which I think is a kind of fun thing. And the band who are playing a kind of Baroque version of Super Freak, which yes. just slayed me.
Yes. And again, a touch that I didn't catch when I first saw this when I was 13, that like, you're right. It is such a fantastic touch in the film. All of that whole scene. I mean, I think you're right. It's like there are very few like tonally. I think, like you said, there are very few missed opportunities in the film. And yeah, I where would you see that in a modern comic book movie where they're doing something like that?
No, you just wouldn't. I think we're kind of supposed to take things a bit more seriously. I know there's kind of goofier ones, you know, there's the Guardians of the Galaxy, Thor, Ragnarok, the, you know, the Suicide Squad. but yeah, even them don't kind of quite lean so far into the kind of making everything look like a comic book and making everything quite so, putting it into the realm of the absurd.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, maybe comparing this to Thor Ragnarok, that I think, like, Thor Ragnarok was sold as this really sort of outside the mainstream of, you know, the usual comic book movie. But when I got into it and started watching it, I mean, there were characters like, you know, Jeff Goldblum's character that really worked. But ultimately, it still follows the same Marvel paradigm of, you know, hero, you know, vanquishes the baddie to start the movie. Then he ends up in a situation that he's got to figure out how to get his way out of. Which again, it was kind of weird that it was Thor who had like something attached to him, that kept him like, you know, from being Thor or whatever, like it was attached to his neck that the Valkyrie had or something. It was like kind of almost it felt like it was, how do I want to say it? It was, it felt like it was contrived almost the way that they were trying to jam this sort of offbeat movie into the standard Marvel paradigm where all the beats that you're expecting are supposed to be there of the, you know, oh, all hope is lost. You know, how are they going to make it? Oh, they sort of come together in the end and they vanquish the baddie and, you know, everybody's, you know, happily ever after. And this movie doesn't have that. Like even what we were talking about where they're framing Batman for being the one who kills the Ice Queen. And it's so like, you know, and then Penguin has control of the Batmobile. And he's running all over the city, like, you know, sort of destroying things. And there's this idea that, okay, Batman's the bad guy in the city now and Penguin's the good guy. That really doesn't last that long in the movie. It's only like maybe 20 minutes. And there's no point where it feels like Batman's going to lose at the end. It's more like, how is he going to win? You know, is he going to win by getting Catwoman as you know, to be his bride or not get Catwoman? You know, how is he going to defeat the Penguin? But there's never this sense of like all hope is lost. Like, you know, the Batman sort of like lying there on the ground and, you know, the Penguin's about to defeat him. And like, he just sort of has like some inspiration of power and he, you know, fights back and wins. And we don't know how he's going to do it, but he ends up doing it. Tim Burton doesn't do any of that in this movie. And that's another area that I appreciated, that it had its own kind of beats to it that again, they're more Tim Burton beats than they are your standard sort of epic comic book movie beats.
Yeah. And I appreciated that, I have to say, because sometimes, like you say, things can be a bit contrived and a bit convoluted. And that kind of second act crisis of, you know, what the kind of thing that happens in this movie where, you know, the city turns against Batman, you know, that would be like, you know, in a modern movie, that'd be like the whole of the second act. And because there's always this feeling of like, well, it will be resolved in the end. Sometimes you're just kind of waiting for it to be resolved. So Sometimes that period can be kind of annoying because it's like, all right, so he's turned against them. Yes, he's at his lowest of lows. Okay. And sometimes that can dramatically work, but sometimes it does feel like the movie's just spinning its wheels. And it's just like, yeah, okay, can we get to the part where, you know, he reveals that he's still the good guy and everybody believes him and, you know, and we'll just get this out of the way. Whereas, like you say, you know, and the funny thing is, Like, when he reveals that Penguin's a bad guy, the audience listening to the recording don't know the context of the recording, that it was within the Batmobile, so it doesn't exonerate him, but he just becomes the good guy again.
Right, exactly. Again, it's this idea that I think that Tim Burton has, where he's going to trust as the audience that we're going to be okay with some of these things happening the way they're happening. And I don't know, too, if maybe, like you said, he wasn't interested in doing this movie to begin with, that maybe he also felt like he's going to just blow through certain parts of it and not overdo it, which, again, I think to your point, that if it's correct tonally, then we'll forgive it. Then if it's overly, there's too much plot exposition, but it kind of messes with the tone of the film and disrupts the flow. The decisions that Burton made, whether he was making it because he wasn't as invested and he just wanted to just get through some of these parts, it still worked in that sense for me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, as long as a movie feels of a piece and all the characters, you can kind of trace the line of the character and the act in a kind of relatively consistent way, then generally I'm on board and can kind of slide by these kind of absurdist plot inconsistencies.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of the reasons I think why I like this movie as well, and I've noticed when I tend to look at my comic book movies that I like, they almost are always the second one in the series as opposed to the first one in the series. I think, the exceptions might be like Black Panther or Captain Marvel, but generally it's the second movie. And I think it's part of that is because the whole origin story to me is just like, okay, I've watched, I know this comic book character. I've known them for, like Batman. It's like, I get it. Yes, Batman as a boy, his parents were murdered. And, then he's training to be Batman and all of that stuff. And it's like, you see it enough that it's like, can I just get into Batman? Can I just have Batman happen? And I think that's what made, sometimes with the sequels, I tend to like those better. But this movie, I think in that sense, I appreciated that he was kind of able to kind of skip ahead to certain things. Or like you said, Batman is suddenly exonerated when maybe he didn't really do anything beyond, we don't even know that it's him playing the recording, right? That is exposing the Penguin. It's just that the Penguin's being exposed.
There's a certain element that, like you say about getting to Batman and just like getting over the origin. Not that, I think Batman Begins is a great film and all that. And some of the origin stories is great, but I think that there's a thing about Batman that I think Batman as a character on his own is a bit too dimensional, really. He's a rich guy with dead parents who's a bit broody, and he's a bit flat existing on his own, but he comes to life when contrasted with a kind of twisted mirror image of himself, whether it be in the Joker or the Penguin or the Riddler or any of his iconic villains. It's the chemistry with the villains that makes Batman great, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree there, because I think that's why he is, that's why, like, for example, the old TV show was so big. I mean, yes, the old TV show was completely tongue-in-cheek, but it's, they had all these guest stars playing the baddies, and it's like, okay, here's Cesar Romero, here's Burgess Meredith, Frank Gorshin, all kind of, stars at that time, and they would even bring on stars to play, like, I think they had Milton Berle play some character they invented called Louis the Lilac. And I think you're right that, like, the villains, the rogues gallery that Batman had was what made him work. I think he's very, like you said, he's very two-dimensional. He just kind of comes off. That's another area I think I liked about Tim Burton's Batman, was that Keaton was a little bit more three-dimensional, that he had a little bit more to him than the usual Batman does. But generally, it's like, I think I saw someone on Twitter making fun of the most recent Batman, where they were talking about it being like a darker, grittier Batman. And it's like, yeah, it's what a novel concept, making a movie about a darker, grittier Batman, that, like, everybody seems to be doing that. And I think you're right that, like, when you have really fun villains for Batman to interact with, that's almost where you start to see more of the three-dimensionality come out, whether it's, the romantic part with Catwoman, or, like you said, like, trying to vanquish a Joker or a Penguin or someone like that.
So I guess as we kind of start to wind down this episode, we'll kind of talk about the kind of explosive finale of the film, which again starts in like like an absurdist way. We get the iconic scene of Penguin kidnapping Max Schreck for a second time, this time in a giant duck boat. And then he sends off his penguins who are all have like, I don't know, are all mind controlled or something. Right. We assume because they have these little things on their heads and they all have rockets. So they're going to like blow up Gotham because his first plan doesn't go to plan because he's supposed to have a kind of biblical plan of like killing the firstborn. Right. And that goes to pots. Because like you say, there's no real threat of Batman losing. Like, right. Again, this is played totally absurdly, where there's like a kind of terror train of cages for all these firstborn children that Batman stops and then sends like a kind of RSVP card to say, sorry, the firstborn couldn't make it to the Penguin. And then so that's just kind of quickly resolved in quite hilarious fashion.
Right, because you think in a modern comic book movie, they would feel like they had to do something with that, right? Like that the kids would have to either be held in some kind of precarious way that they might be getting killed soon, or they might be in like a cage that's falling into like some kind of toxic waste or something like that. And for it to just be, you know, Batman showing up and, you know, hitting, you know, Vincent Chiavelli just like taking the train away from him and taking the kids, and like you said, giving the monkey the RSVP, it's very different from what we expect now from comic book movies, where it's like, no, these kids, I mean, they probably wouldn't have wanted to go through the trouble of all the firstborn, because they would want to have it be like, you know, this precarious thing where it's like, you know, Spider-Man having to save, you know, Gwen Stacy or Mary Jane Parker or whatever, you know, who's hanging from some ledge or something, and you know, can Spider-Man save them? This, like you said, there's no danger of these kids ever being, you know, in any kind of predicament, because Batman just takes the train away from them.
And I know, like you say, yeah, again, in that kind of like modern filmmaking and like we've made today, there would have to be threat. Saved at the last minute. It wouldn't be so easily resolved. Whereas, like, yeah, most things in this movie are pretty easily resolved. But like, again, I think tonally, I think it totally works with the kind of absurdist Burton-esque feel of the movie.
Yeah, because if you think about it, the only time that you get something like that is when the Ice Queen is standing on the ledge and they just kill her off. So it's like, even there, like there's this idea of like, oh, is Batman going to save her at the last minute? No, Burton just kills her off. And you know, of course they make the joke, Catwoman says, I thought you were just gonna scare her, and Penguin's like, well, she looked pretty scared to me. What do you think? But you know, even that's almost like flying in the face of how these movies are supposed to be, where, you know, the person's supposed to be saved at the end, right? You can't just kill off somebody like that.
One of the things is, it's kind of funny because like we're talking there about like kind of creating a modern film would kind of create more threat and be more scary in a way of being like, oh, we might be killing these kids. We won't really, but we're going to try and convince you that we are. So on the one hand, this movie is much lighter than like a modern movie might be. But on the other hand, it is also much darker in some ways, particularly with the kind of last kind of fight. You know, basically, Penguin is his bad plan backfires him because the penguins come back because Batman jams the frequency and they all come back, and he is like, yeah, he's kind of taken out by that. And then we have this kind of final scene with Max Schreck and Catwoman, where Max Schreck is continually shooting Catwoman and she's, you know, absorbing it because of her 9 lives that are unexplained. And the one thing as a kid that completely freaked me out the first time I watched this at 8 or 9 years old is when Catwoman gives Max Schreck the taser kiss. And then we see 2 minutes later, Max Schreck's completely burnt face.
Yes. And I think you're absolutely right that as a kid, right, you don't see the sort of like comic, like almost like scary haunted house aspect, yes, of it. You see it as just like this frightening thing that happened. And also, right, as a kid, you don't realize you're watching like Chekhov's taser, right? That if there's a taser in the first scene, you've got to use it in the last scene of the film.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Right, But it, you know, watching it now, right? You're right. Like, you know, as a kid, I think I probably had a similar reaction to that. I think, you know, I think for me, when I watched the first, when I watched this movie in the film, I was so worried that I was going to get something like the original, you know, the first Batman, where you, again, you had people, you know, disfigured with acid, you know, all kinds of danger. And, you know, it is like, you didn't know what Jack Nicholson's character was going to do and how bad it was going to be when he did it. That I think the entire film, I was just waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it never quite got there. And I think that might, I think that and the nose bite might be the two closest points to where it gets to the kind of how kind of rough the first film was with some of those things.
And then that's pretty much it. And the thing that we didn't really mention, I guess, is that the film is set at Christmas, and that's why it's a Christmas special, and it's very Christmassy throughout, and it ends with a Merry Christmas message where Alfred says Merry Christmas to Bruce. And then Bruce says, yeah, Merry Christmas and goodwill to all men, pause, and women, because they're people too, apparently. which is a very strangely red line. But yes, and that's, so we're sent off with a Merry Christmas. And even though we think Catwoman's dead, we get one final shot of Catwoman to see that she's still alive. And so we all end very happily with a very Merry Christmas.
Yes, and it's interesting because I always think of Die Hard as a Christmas movie as well. But you're right. I think this movie, kind of in the same way as Die Hard, they use Christmas as a backdrop to the film. But then there's also commentary on Christmas. Like, so I think, you know, the consumerism of Christmas, you know, we get to see Catwoman blowing up Shrek's department store, you know, when there's that sort of the Christmas stuff going on there. And I think in the UK, I think they had cut some of that scene when they released it to get it to like a certain level.
Yes, they did. There was some cuts by the BBC. It's to do with the spray cans, where she puts the spray cans in the microwave because they felt that this was imitable behavior. And so they didn't want anybody doing that or imitating that. So they took that out of the movie. It seems very unlikely that anybody would be imitating that necessarily, but at the same time, yeah, that was the part they cut out. I think they cut out another part too, but that was the main part that they cut out about 9 seconds.
Yeah, and I guess the other piece, right, is the tree lighting ceremony, which again, that's something that in America, it has gotten to this huge place where the Rockefeller Plaza tree lighting thing, where I think last year they were doing, I think the Goo Goo Dolls were performing at it. It was like a big TV special for it. And so I can see Tim Burton, you know, because that's, you know, where we get our first, like, our first action sequence in the film and our first attack from the baddies is at the tree lighting ceremony in Gotham. That, you know, again, it's one of those things where he's almost sort of like taking the commercialism of Christmas and, you know, which in the 90s was not even quite at the level, especially here in the United States where it is now, where it's like, you know, the whole idea of like the Black Friday, which is now like, you know, the entire month of November. I mean, one of the biggest jokes we make here is that like you start seeing Christmas things in like late August, you know, in stores and things like that, because they push it to such a degree. You know, that's, I think, you know, Burton was kind of making fun of that in a way that I think kind of in the same way that Die Hard did too, where it was like, you know, he's going to a Christmas party. He doesn't really want to be going to that. He's only even out there to visit his family for Christmas. And he's kind of like over it all at that point. And then he's got to fight his way through this big building when he really didn't have the energy to do any of it. Yeah. It's kind of, people, when they talk about Christmas movies, there's that sense of like a Christmas movie has to be about Christmas. And that's what makes it a Christmas movie. Whereas I think Batman Returns, having it set in Christmas, was almost more like a commentary on Christmas than it was. I mean, Christmas plays a part as well, but I appreciated the commentary as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few kind of commentaries going on, and particularly about the commercialization of Christmas, and also about the kind of corporate fronts of like Max Schreck puts on this kind of charitable front, where actually he's like, not only a backstabbing businessman who's polluting the water of Gotham, but is also an actual murderer. And so there's definitely commentary there. Obviously, I guess that most of the billionaire owners of the world nowadays are not actual murderers, but I think there's definitely a commentary there about, and you still see it today where it's like, Disney celebrates Pride Month and also gives money to gay conversion therapy. McDonald's believes Black Lives Matter if that's going to make sales higher.
Yes. Well, right. Like the best example I think of here in the United States is Starbucks, where they have been, actively trying to prevent their baristas from unionizing. But at the same time, they're like, oh, look at what we're doing to for free, fair trade coffee, or, we're giving money to this thing. And it's like, well, okay, that's great. You're giving that money to that thing. It's almost like this kind of like sleight of hand thing, right? That like, hey, look at all the nice stuff we're doing over here while we're, doing everything we can to prevent our workers from forming a union. And people, you wonder like, yeah, it's almost like this idea that because Max Schreck is so popular, right, in the city of Gotham, that it's almost like they let people feel better maybe about, going to Max Schreck's place and buying stuff, even if they, know that he's polluting the water or something like that, they feel better about it. But it is, like you say, it's a very fascinating thing that like that's sort of like the charitable sleight of hand. Because I think the Disney one's a great example as well. Like, yeah, like we'll support candidates who vote in favor of all of these horrible things, but yet it's, we're celebrating Pride Month with all these great movies.
Ah, dear. Well, we'll try and end on a happier note. we'd like to wish all our listeners a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, whatever you're celebrating, even though this is definitely not, this definitely absolutely really being recorded on Christmas Day.
Right. And I think maybe from a Christmas standpoint, I definitely, in terms of your Christmas movie viewing, this is, if you don't, if you haven't thought about this movie in a long time, this is kind of a fun add to your Christmas viewing movie, depending on who you're watching Christmas movies with, I guess.
So before we head on out, do you want to give any kind of social media plugs, tell people where you're at, anything you want to promote?
Yeah, absolutely. So the site is dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com. And that's really where kind of everything is. So you've got the links on Twitter. I think it's DTV Connoisseur, either DTV Connoisseur or DTVC on Instagram. But all the links are there on the site. And then also I have two novels out. Hopefully by the time this is published, there'll be a third novel out. I'm hoping to get it out end of this month. So the two are Chad and Accounting and A Girl and a Gun. And then hopefully the third one called Holtman Arms. That will also be out. And again, the links to those are on the site, dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com, or you can look up Chad and Accounting on Amazon. That's usually the best way because that's one that's a very unique title. And then you can click on my name and that will give you all the titles that I have on there.
It just leaves me to say thank you very much for coming on the show, Matt. Thanks to everybody for listening and checking out this latest episode of All 90s Action All the Time. If you really enjoyed the episode, please do rate, review, and subscribe to us on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get podcasts from. And if you do really, really like this show, we'd be much appreciated if you give us a 5-star review, because that really helps with the algorithm. Anything less, apparently the algorithm thinks we're shit, so you don't want that on your conscience. So please, 5 stars. And that's all for this time. Please do join us again next time, where we will return in January along with Matt again to talk about Jackie Chan's City Hunter. Until then, though, see ya.